Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations happening in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets.
Welcome to the first video version of The Gauge. Delighted to be here at the Digital Frontier HQ in London. I'm joined by Nick Carey, co-founder of Blockchain.com. Honored to have you with us, Nick.
Thank you for hosting.
We met initially a few years ago.
It's been a little bit now.
I think it was in Westminster.
We may have. That's an unusual place to have a first meeting and have it all be copacetic and great. So,
but both of us, funnily enough, are Americans.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get the UK to be a success story.
So. I think so. We've been rooting for the UK for a long time. I've been living here now for over a decade as an American who's having an international abroad experience. So you come back to the UK and a lot of the history here sort of echoes in America. And I think there's this really beautiful thing happening, which is we're learning from each other, and there's things that work really well here, and there's things we can import from the US experience that give us advantages, and there's some lessons that could probably go the other way too.
Which is exciting.
Yeah.
And I'm also very excited to hear about your story. I think a lot of our viewers are keen to learn about why you started blockchain.com, how you got in the space.
Yeah, happy to talk about all of that. Everyone has their own unconventional path into entrepreneurship, but we all start off as entrepreneurs, actually. And one of my favorite questions I love to ask either new employees or people I meet is, how did you earn your first buck, your first dollar, or first euro? And everyone sits back and thinks, oh, it was when my grandfather gave me a job to go collect all the leaves in the backyard, or lemonade stand, or selling candy on the playground. And I love that because that entrepreneurial spirit is really in everybody. And then for various reasons, sometimes that gets suppressed or not encouraged enough. But for me, it was really young. I wanted to get a CD player, and all the people I knew had cool ones and I didn't have one. So I needed to earn some money. And I would go out and collect clams in the Long Island Sound and sell them to all my geriatric neighbors. And right. I don't think people eat rock clams anymore, but back then it was not that uncommon. But I guess the shellfish is still popular. That was how I started making some money, and I did really well, and I would deliver them. And I had to manage my inventory. And I made enough money to buy my first CD player. And then after that, I was hooked to acquiring more money, but doing things that were fun to do so. And I ended up making a bunch of websites with my best friend in high school. We built an early e-commerce site. We built an early intranet for basically encrypted messaging. And then we built an e-commerce site called usablankets.com, which did really, really well, funnily enough. And so we built a few of these things, and we had no idea how to price anything. We were 17, 18 years old. And I learned a very important lesson, which is you have to be careful how you price things. We did a deal with this company called Fontino's Subs, which was a sandwich company next to our office. And we said we wouldn't charge them, except that we required lifetime free sandwiches. And that deal did not work well because after a couple of years, the company went under and no more free sandwiches. But it was a funny, good lesson. But we learned a lot by building those websites. That's how I got into tech, basically. And then studied essentially international political economy in university. And after I finished university, became a teacher, taught computer science and creative writing in India. And this was when I was 21. And so I had this like entrepreneurial and then teaching background. And I always loved tech. And I always tend to come back to that. And so after working in India for a while, I was one of the founding partners of Pipeline CRM, which is customer relationship management software, very early SaaS player. We were one of the first customers of AWS. And that was a fantastic business. And I owe a lot of the business acumen that I developed in my career really to that first experience, because we were selling against huge companies like Salesforce and SAP and Oracle. And we would learn from other businesses how they made money. So we'd sit down with a CEO and we'd say, explain to us how you make money, and we're gonna set up a sales process using our software that'll help you deliver on that more quickly. And so these CEOs would reveal their most important secret, which was their business model and how they take care of customers. And I did thousands of onboardings looking at all these different industries and learning from the CEOs of companies how they sold and how they made money. And that learning experience was so crucial early on. It was an absolutely great lesson and a great way to learn. So fast forward a little bit, you have the great financial crisis of 2008, and the world's markets are in absolute turbulence. And as a young person who had believed a lot in the story of if you work hard and there's merit in the world, you'll be rewarded. And it was really disconcerting to see the leaders in the world and the institutions that we thought had so much gravitas so colossally mismanaged. And it really caused me to question a lot about what the path that we were supposed to be on, whether or not that was accurate, whether or not that was a worthy one. And it was very early on, thanks to some university friends I went to school with, that I learned about the digital currency called Bitcoin. That is the first chapter. And then really, when I first discovered it, I have to say, I think like a lot of people, it sounds, when you hear that it's possible for a computer system to basically develop a counterfeit-resistant digital good, you go, what does that mean? And then you need to understand some fundamentals about economics and currency and how money is created in the traditional world and the fiat world, and then have some historical context. But basically, humans have been using money for tens of thousands of years. It's a prehistoric concept. It predates a written word. That's why in burial sites in northern Scotland, you find beads and pearls from the Middle East. They find seeds that were used as a form of currency. We've used gold, we've used paper. So money is really just a social construct we use to exchange wealth over time. And it's best to think of it like a technology. And just like markets advance and improve, the technology of money has advanced and improved. And in the age of the internet, it makes sense to revisit our relationship with money. And so Bitcoin really does that in a very interesting way by proposing a novel economic system that uses hard money concepts, which is to say it looks and behaves a little bit more like a digital gold. That is to say that there's a fixed and limited supply of the currency that was hardwired in the network itself. The network is extremely decentralized. It is supported by a whole bunch of computer systems all over the world that run the blockchain. But individual participants basically secure each one of those nodes or the backups of the entire history of all the transactions on the network. So you have a decentralized record-keeping system. You have a native hard asset currency on it. And then you've got settlement with finality, which means that people can exchange information, and it, once it's complete, it can't be unwound. Those are all the necessary ingredients to basically forge a completely novel, new, fit-to-purpose financial system for the internet. So when I learned about that, I was extremely persuaded by the arguments around hard money for the internet. It needed to be decentralized, so you didn't have any perverse incentives. Mm. You didn't want the network to be able to spawn new currency out of thin air on an unregulated basis, causing the type of inflation we see both in Western democracies today, but in also in frontier markets where mismanagement of money causes colossal destruction of wealth. Mm. So Bitcoin comes on the scene, and I learn about it very early on, and I'm extremely intrigued by it, but from a philosophical and economic perspective. And then the technology aspects get exciting too. And it's like people need to build things in order for this to become more useful. And that's when I got involved with blockchain.info, which was a predecessor project to what would become blockchain.com. So it's a long story, but it has a lot of details because it's worth explaining the steps to it. And that's how I ended up in the UK. My British business partner started blockchain.info as a website that would create the first Block Explorer. Mm-hmm. Block Explorer is an open source tool to search essentially the Bitcoin blockchain at the time. And the information architecture, the language we use now, was really originally designed by this developer and our team in the early days of blockchain.info. It's been used now for all the other block explorers on the internet. And that product was very popular. It helped us basically start to map out how many people were adopting crypto and Bitcoin specifically in the first few years, what kind of economic velocity there was, what the address distribution was. And we were listening to customers. And that's a key thing, was just building stuff they found interesting and useful. And that led us to launching our flagship product, which would become what we're most well known for today, which is our wallet software. Yeah. And so because we had the first iOS wallet, and that wallet vintage was the 2012-2013 vintage of crypto adopters, which is to say, essentially the very first million users, that cohort would become extremely valuable to our company's success over the duration.
I see you as well as being an OG, if I may. And I'm always intrigued. Obviously, international political economy is one of these more social sciences-based degrees. But the combination of tech and that philosophical thinking, I hear a lot in some of the original entrants into the space, particularly the libertarian bent.
Yeah. The school I went to was a small liberal arts school, and it definitely practiced, like I would say, more traditional international relations-styled political economy. But my friend group was quite... I would say they were questioning, they were trying to examine the world, and they were a bit suspicious. And we would have conversations late at night and interrogate what we were discussing in class. And I would say we were not in the consensus view of what was being taught to us, but we thought there were probably better ways of doing things. To me, we were also native children of the internet, which is to say that we were gaining access and spending time online and expanding our horizons around what was dogma versus what wasn't and what was new and challenging ideas quickly. And a lot of the early crypto people, they all shared this suspicion and maybe a bit of a suspicion of authority, but also the older systems. Why are things the way they are? Do they have to be that way, or can they be different? Can they be improved? And a healthy amount of suspicion or concern for the way things have always been done is a healthy thing to have. And yeah, it was definitely in the psychology of many of the early founders of digital currency companies.
I have two questions. Yeah. One, obviously blockchain.com is an amazing name. It'd be great to hear a bit of the evolution. I appreciate the wallets is the first product market fit, if you will. But where is the business today? The second question then is, obviously you've been on a journey getting to meet some interesting characters along the way. If you could mention maybe one or two anecdotes of people you've met.
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's fun to revisit these things because after about a decade of time, sometimes you don't go through the memories and you have to refresh them. So hopefully won't be exaggerating too much to emphasize. But early characters, I remember right not far from here, we had our first and second, third offices in Shoreditch in London. And we had Vitalik come visit us in 2014, and he was really excited about his new initiative. And he was a big fan of blockchain.info as a block explorer. And I remember he was so optimistic, and his vision for building a world computer was carried on this pioneering spirit of, we're going to take some of the things we learned in the early days of Bitcoin and apply them in an even more grander world. What people don't realize maybe today is I don't recall, especially the early Bitcoin community, to be hostile in any way or tribal in the way that much of crypto has become, I think, since then. We were all fighting against the man, which was the traditional financial system, and trying to develop legitimacy and building things people would find useful. And there was a lot of early spirit of collaboration and cooperation. And then it turned a little bit and everyone started working on their own things. And that was a natural progression, and also probably helped because you created competition. And if Bitcoin and these other networks were going to survive, they needed to be highly resilient to competition itself and being anti-fragile, meaning it can't be at risk of one thing damaging the prosperity of the whole project. That is to say, it was interesting, some of the personalities that were involved in the early days, but I remember him coming by our office and giving us a preview of what would become Ethereum before it launched. And I remember thinking, that is a hugely ambitious project and good work. And it's been amazing to see that community thrive and flourish and then inspire derivatives of that network and other ideas too. And so I always think even today in 2025, there's some kid out there who is dreaming up something that is far better than anything that we've even conceived. And it's going to be better and cheaper and faster. And it's going to deliver on the promises that have been laid before and have yet to be fulfilled. So there's this sort of weird tension between trying to keep things pure and stable versus different and better. In the long run of time, technology improves, systems advance, upgrades occur, and our ideas that we have for what we're able to do expand. And so I'm quite encouraged by where we are today. If you were to go back 5-10 years ago and ask anyone in our space, do you think the president of the United States would announce a Bitcoin strategic reserve at any point in the next century? And you'd be like, that's probably not on my bingo card. But that's happened in 2025. It's a $3 trillion asset class. BlackRock, which is right around the corner here, just launched an ETP for Europe, has an ETF that makes it possible for anyone in the United States with a brokerage account to get exposure to Bitcoin without having to worry about private keys or custody or anything else. And so to me, you know, the incredible distance that's been traveled, what's been forged and built is a great foundation. And now we really have a lot of work to do still over the next few decades to bring this thing, what I call, to internet scale. We've developed a good foundation, but people aren't using this every day yet to make payments. They are, I would say, to do a lot of cross-border or larger payments on the internet. But I don't think we've gotten to the point where we've achieved the electronic money status or reserve asset of the internet or the world yet. And those are big ideas, and it still needs to earn that position, but it's working toward it.
In terms of blockchain.com itself, obviously the markets with the current US administration very euphoric about potentially doing IPOs. How are you positioning the business and what are the verticals that you think are going to get the most traction to get the best valuation if you yourselves list?
So good question. So we're a venture-backed company. We've raised nearly $1 billion over the last decade. Mm. And we are ourselves positioning the company to explore a public offering in the near future. What happens is you basically take all of the work you've done and you start to add new muscle against the organization and you prepare to essentially face off to a completely different type of customer. And in the crypto space, we've been really focused on retail investors and in the last 4 years, supporting more institutions, which is to say high net worth individuals, family offices, other crypto companies, foundations in this space, and then more sophisticated crossover investors from TradFi. Mm. And they've all started to begin dabbling. Some of them are doing more advanced stuff. Others need help navigating the space. And so we've built two sides of our business. And we did this very deliberately because while retail revenue is really good when the market is going up and there's a lot of arguably price volatility, it's very hard to make money when the market changes and goes in a different direction. Crypto is highly cyclical. In the last decade and a half, there is this four-year historical pattern, which isn't perfect, but it looks something like this. Year one is pretty good. There's a decent amount of new market participants. Year two, you have a crazy big year where 10x the number of people basically come in. There's euphoria, the new market highs. And then you have a crazy correction where you can have an up to more than once 90% drawdown in trading volumes, in price action, in new economic participants. And in order to build a company, if you think about it, that can survive in both those environments, you have to have very flexible systems, both on the technology side and on the operation side. And then the year after that, you have a year of accumulation and the whole thing starts over. One of the things driving that cycle is the fact that the most established digital currency, which is Bitcoin, reduces its supply that is coming into circulation by 50% every 4 years. So just like there's lunar cycles and there's electoral cycles, we have a foundational element in our market, which is the largest, most valuable asset actually reduces the amount of new currency coming to circulation by 50% every 4 years. That seems to set off a tightening in the supply, while on the other side, there's continuing demand. So if there's less of something and more people trying to get it, you have price action generally to the upside. That's been a pattern that's been well observed over the last 15 years, but navigating the ups and downs of it as a business itself gets really tricky. So long story short, it has not been very easy to take crypto companies public. In fact, only one has been successful, and then they were sued by the regulator that allowed them to go public in the first place. Now, interestingly, the companies that have been able to fight in courts have won most of their court cases. With the transition of the American administration, we now have moved from a position of hostility to one of embrace. And at the end of the day, crypto is never intended to be partisan. If anything, this is a technology that should be well and easy to embrace by all sides of the aisle. It's about opening market access, developing capabilities that make it easier to bank people that are unbanked or underbanked or from low or modest income backgrounds, putting capabilities in their pocket to move money around better, cheaper, faster, and putting people more in control of their financial future. And there's so many inspiring stories about how people with access to digital currency wallets have been able to flourish in places they otherwise would never have had access to a bank account. So the big idea is still to basically build a more efficient economic engine for the world using this software and these capabilities. And so there are a handful of companies positioning to go public over the next 12 months. And what's exciting about that is we're going to get the opportunity to educate a whole new class of investors and teach our business model to the street and have them get bought into using these things. And ultimately, what's going to be really interesting is we've been all competing against each other, but we're very likely to start competing against the old legacy and largest financial institutions in the world. And locking horns with them is going to be a good thing. It's going to create better outcomes for consumers. And I'm excited about it because as a technology-driven company, we have a lot of advantages in that contest. And those are some of the things going into it. But building up the psychology in the company, moving from a tech startup to a mature business to an IPO-ready public company business is a very different kind of psychology. And we're very ready for that journey, having been in it for 14 years. But there's going to be this kind of interesting dynamic potentially, which is you'll have companies that goes public in the traditional markets where many of the other crypto projects, protocols, or foundations will never go public. They're already arguably public. through their token issuances. Yep. And that path doesn't have any of the type of burdensome requirements or anything else. It'll be interesting to see if that becomes a way forward for all other types of businesses, not just crypto ones specifically, but ones that want to have a novel model for rewarding their customers, for rewarding their shareholders. And as traditional markets and digital markets merge and tokenization of all things and real world assets comes true, it's likely that you'll see less traditional IPOs and more token events of all type.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Watch this space.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that I've really respected you for, and something we both have an interest in, is the broader topic of crypto for good, crypto philanthropy. And I know you specifically have taken that on to a direct engagement with your charity, Sky's the Limit.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I appreciate you've been a great ally in supporting and lifting up the community here in London, and it's so desperately needed. We have a few examples of these great foundations that are set up that support everything from the arts to medical research causes or education. And a lot of these things happen at the end of someone's career, at the end of their life. And it's good to give back at any time, but there's something important about strengthening that muscle system and practicing that a bit earlier in one's career. And I have the privilege of working with one of my very close friends to support an entrepreneurship service organization called skyslimit.org. Really, this is just personal, but it comes down to there's two things that motivate me in the world. One is what I've been doing for the last 15 years around trying to reinvent people's relationship with money. That's a big deal. I think the financial system is parasitic and quite broken. It's a rent-seeking business model, and it has slightly perverse outcomes. Some people get extraordinarily wealthy out of it, wealth concentrates, and you do not necessarily arguably have equal access to these systems and tools which advantage and disadvantage aspects of our society. And so building a better, cheaper, faster financial system that's more inclusive, that makes it more accessible to people all over the world, benefits everybody. You build something that moves money around the world faster, more economic velocity, you can raise standard of livings, you can create new markets, and you will deeply integrate people's interdependencies around the world in a way that creates peace and prosperity for more people. So crypto and Bitcoin specifically inspired my career and that body of work. The other thing that matters a lot, though, is you really do need to encourage and support early stage entrepreneurs to go out there and build the things that are needed in our communities, and can start off with something as simple as your first business and learning and practicing a bit more about taking care of customers and finding product market fit. We need to encourage more entrepreneurship in a diverse way, but also in a way that looks more representative of the composition of our society, so that wealth is being created in pockets and places that weren't traditionally being forged. So skyslimit.org is a direct intervention to what I would describe as a market failure today, which is to support early stage, predominantly underestimated entrepreneurs. What does that mean to be underestimated? It's a catch-all phrase for us. It basically means you're from a low-income background. And if you're from a low-income background and trying to start a business, you will have disadvantages. Yeah. We want to help support you. We do that with entrepreneurship education. We do that with access to mentors and advisors that we recruit from incredible companies. They come and partner with us. Those companies include firms like Goldman Sachs, Accenture, CVC Capital, PNC Bank, and many more. They bring their staff, they onboard, they volunteer their time and support our early stage entrepreneurs. For those that are ready, they can create a pitch and they can request grant funding from our team. We issue them small checks to go buy their first line of apparel, to set up that store if they want to put down a deposit, if they want to test it, to set up a website and practice building their companies. All this is done through an app. We have this capability of measuring all the impact and telling stories about these entrepreneurs. And we've even experimented doing some crypto stuff in here, for example, by launching a decentralized autonomous grant vehicle, among other things. And we have a long-term plan for doing more work with crypto over the next decade and more. The two things that care about, again, are these levers of building a better financial system, but then encouraging more economic activity via entrepreneurship. If we do those things, we can have outsized outcomes and better impact in the world.
I remember the first time you told me about a charity DAO. I thought this is the coolest thing. Definitely groundbreaking. One of the areas that I'd maybe like to explore a little bit more, I remember I went to one of the refugee entrepreneur events that you did, and here are people that obviously have given up everything to come, and they're doing business. And here you were giving them a leg up, but the ideas that they had were fabulous. Maybe if you could just talk to particularly the story of maybe the winner of that competition, which I found really remarkable.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I was here in London. We worked with a group of refugee entrepreneurs that were all young, had extraordinary stories for escaping and being dislodged from their communities and families, traveling across borders, being chased, and losing everything, their personal security, leaving families behind and more. You hear those things and you go, I got nothing to complain about today. And then when they arrive and seek asylum, it's sometimes very difficult for them to actually get the right to work or even get a bank account, get an address. The steps to begin to integrate can be very, very long. And so we ran a program that was focused on hopefully finding through self-employment means to develop income and speed up the process of integrating. We had a bunch of entrepreneurs that, because they've seen the worst of the world, one, they have extraordinary resiliency, which is like a superpower in entrepreneurship. And it's always going to be difficult to start a company, regardless of whether it's a coffee shop or a fintech company. But I find especially immigrant founders and ones that have adversity in their backgrounds are in some ways better prepared for entrepreneurship than almost anybody else, interestingly, even ones that come from privileged university backgrounds. And these young entrepreneurs came to us and they developed their business ideas and they came and pitched and we gave away a bunch of money and some laptops to help them get started. The winner was this young Glaswegian kid who wanted to teach the teacher, basically. He had set up a coffee shop. He's an extraordinarily good barista. And his idea was to basically train up other refugee entrepreneurs that were in a similar situation to him, pass on the skills he's learned, and basically launch these small bespoke sustainable coffee shops in Northern England and Scotland. He was extremely charismatic, very capable entrepreneur, and checked in on him a little bit ago and same old smile. It was really encouraged by those types of moments help remind us all that we're better together if we cooperate. Mutual benefit is something that helps lift everybody up. It's what forges and builds these great cities. We need to pass it down. The knowledge and skills that we have is critical to maintaining the integrity of our society.
I also enjoyed reading your book, Building Business Together. You co-wrote with Bo.
Yeah, so we wrote a book and it was called Building Business Together. And the idea really is that there's too much celebration of these singular entrepreneurs, in my opinion. There's a reason we love worshiping heroes and it's great and it's easy to remember one name or whatever. But no one does anything by themselves. There's this huge support system behind them. They've got teams. They've got therapists. They have family members that are supportive. They've got other people that are involved and allies that are helping them build their businesses. To us, one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that anyone can be an entrepreneur, but it's a lot more fun to go do it with a support system. That's one of the things we try to deliver on at Sky's the Limit, bringing mentors and advisors, coaches, and help you think about your business and get that emotional and practical support, and then back it up with peer support. One of the things you and I can easily bond on is basically anything related that's annoying in building business, because only people that are building businesses experience those annoyances. Entrepreneurs can bond with other entrepreneurs very quickly and easily because they face similar challenges, regardless of what kind of businesses they're building. So building a community of peers and support for those peers is really what we're about.
Last question for me. Where are some of the bright stars or bright lights you see coming out in particularly the blockchain or crypto space? Anything to follow?
Well, it's important. The industry has ups and downs. There are years that are great. There are years that where it's tough because the market, the valuations of projects and companies and tokens and the total addressable market seems to shrink and grow. But if you just look back on what's been achieved, it's important to take stock and study some of the lessons. And we have a lot to be proud of. We have a lot of work to do still. And we have to continually earn the trust of our customers and trust of community. But there's a real shift in the trade winds where for the first 10 years, there was so much antagonism toward the industry and a lot of questions about whether or not this would ever work. There was no credentialing to it whatsoever. That's really changed a lot. And so we're past the adoption curve of the internet nerds and the super early adopters and the cultural zeitgeist. This thing is now becoming mass market. There's going to be some really interesting things and opportunities over the next decade. And a slightly optimistic perspective on the change of tone from the United States is that they get it now, which is to say that a digital economy fueled by digital payments is a really potentially beneficial thing to the health of the American economy. By exporting that and embracing it, it's good for everybody that we trade with. I'm really pleased by the changes and the change of tone, and also the fact that this has become more bipartisan in this last electoral cycle, actually, than in previous ones. And so the President of the United States has announced a digital asset strategic reserve and a Bitcoin strategic reserve. In the last century, the United States backed up its dollar with two things, petrol and gold.
Yeah.
And in the next century, when while rare earth minerals are still very valuable and have a role to play in as commodities and backing up the American institutions, digital assets are going to play a very critical one too. We need to get better at moving electrons around the world, sharing and exchanging precious information over the internet. Blockchains are fit to purpose for doing this. And so you're going to have, I would say, better always on financial markets. You're going to have a really interesting intersection between all the work happening across artificial intelligence and Bitcoin. And here's the reason why. I have a prediction within 5 years, the majority of online economic activity will be conducted by AI agents or artificial intelligence software, but it'll be using crypto to perform that economic activity. And that's because even though you run a bank, maybe you'll be able to set up AI agents with bank accounts someday. It's not easy right now. It's not clear you can even do that. But AI agents can definitely set up a crypto wallet. In fact, they already have and are already making payments to each other. They're buying and selling content from each other. Soon they'll probably buy, I would say, energy and more compute resources. That all sounds crazy, but what does it practically mean? Well, it means you could have a personal CFO as an application connected to your brokerage account, and you can task that CFO with a budget, and you could say, I want you to look at the top 10 trading strategies of the best traders that you can find on Twitter, and I want you to copy what they do and dollar cost average $50 of my savings into their strategies every week. And this system will just spin up, use a crypto wallet, go follow those trading strategies, and run on its own until you tell it to do something else. Or you could give it more specific parameters. You could have it keep your fridge full of the types of fruits and vegetables you want. That's one simple example, but there'll be many of these types of things. And so the intersection between AI and crypto is very obvious. I'm really excited about the synergies that'll come from that. And then the other trends that are very likely, we hear a lot about the tokenization of RWAs, which are real world assets. And in the traditional financial space right now, the hottest thing is private markets, meaning weird stuff you're not able to buy in any other place. And this is what most of the major financial institutions are pivoting around, building up private markets businesses. And tokenization of private markets is going to be fascinating, which is to say, maybe you always wanted to sell part of your distillery that you own in Scotland or the airport in Amsterdam, and you could sell a piece of it, tokenize it, and offer it basically to the public. Those capabilities now exist via blockchain technology. There are now regulatory pathways that are being laid to make these things more possible. I'm very encouraged by that stuff too. So basically all the things where there's a lot of latent capital that didn't have liquidity and didn't have the ability to find customers can now do so. Those are some of the things that I think are going to happen, which is very encouraging for anyone that's working in the space. I think the future is bright.
Fascinating as always.
Great.
Nick, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so very much.